And now I would like to introduce our first speaker. And I just met him myself. And I would like to thank Larry very much for stepping up. And here's Larry.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Larry, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Larry.
And until about 10 minutes ago, I was really enjoying this conference. I need to describe a couple of things to you. The nice thing is the fact that there's a podium up here so you can't see my knees knocking. And I thank God I can hold on to the sides because you don't want to hear this the whole time. This is what you get for being a smart guy. We comfortably were sitting back there and started giving our next speaker here a little bit of a hard time. And this is what's called payback. My sobriety date is January 19th, 1982. I thank God and you people for that fact in my life. The Bethel Group in Upper Marlboro, Maryland is my home group. We meet on Saturday night. My brother, thank you. And anytime you're in Maryland outside of Washington, D.C. on a Saturday night, come on down because we like to feel we have the best home group in the world. And I am nervous. They asked me when I wanted to speak, and I said, please first, because I'll have a heart attack if I don't. This will be the most impromptu speech of the convention, so I would ask that you, number one, pray for me, and number two, be tolerant. I even had to ask what the topic was. I was coming here to support Jack, so I'll read the magazine the next time or something, follow direction. I can share from my experience only, and that's what I'll do with you people. I also have to acknowledge on the front end that I normally introduce myself with my full name, and in deference to the wishes of the conference, I don't do that. So anybody that wants to know how to get in touch with me, if they come to Washington, D.C. and want to call for a meeting, I'll give you my last name afterwards. But, you know, I'm a typical alcoholic. That's all I can say. I'm Irish. I came by this naturally. And There's a couple of quick stories I'll mention real quick. Well, one I'll tell you real quick is the fact that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I came here, I happened to be here for the prior meeting, and the woman sitting here, I was just telling one of the guys, I had to come up and I cried in her arms afterwards because she told my story. We had a totally different concept of God, but I felt every feeling she's ever felt in her life, and I knew exactly where she was coming from because I came here wanting to die. I also came here and I didn't know that you people didn't drink. Talk about a rude awakening, you know. But when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was a hopeless, helpless drunk when I came here shaking and baking and ready to sit on my hands and didn't even know it. And I met a guy, and his name happened to be Fast Eddie, and it was 2 o'clock on a Monday afternoon. And he said that he hadn't had a drink in 7 years, so I knew he was a liar. Nobody's gone 7 years. And he asked me if I wanted a cup of coffee, and I said yes, and he gave me half a cup of coffee, so I thought he was cheap. And he knew what I didn't know. I couldn't hold a cup of coffee. But I wanted to impress him because I wanted him to know how special a person he was dealing with. And so I asked him, you know, I actually told him straight out, and I said, you know, I do have 3 college degrees. And he said, that's good. He said, you know how many degrees there are in a rectal thermometer? And I'm a very smart guy, and I said, yes, I do. I didn't get it at all. I said, there's 108. He said, that's right. And do you know where they tell you to stick that? So he told me, he said, I've never met anybody too dumb to get this program, but I've met a lot of people too smart. So take those degrees and stick them outside the front door. Thank God that Eddie said that to me. The other things that Eddie did, Eddie introduced me that night. He asked me to come back, and he introduced me to 3 guys. And so those 4 men that I had never met before in my life and I never knew anything about, and I have to say this, 3 of them are dead now. They carried a perfect message of hope and recovery to this alcoholic. They introduced me to the notions of a sponsor, and they introduced me to the notions of a step. And just very briefly, I want to tell you a little bit my experience with the fourth step. And as I came in here, and I got working through the steps, and I did the first three steps, and I got to the fourth step. And, you know, none of us are dumb. You know, the trouble with the fourth step is we can all read the fifth step. The fourth step isn't the problem. I mean, let's face it. We can all talk about ourselves. We can tell everyone. It's just you don't want to have to do it to somebody else. And so I'm working with three guys. I got to tell you, the four guys actually. Fast Eddie, who died a couple of years ago, God bless him. Jim Landy, who's dead now, and I'll use his last name, and he was a locksmith from Pennsylvania. Leo Connors was a retired D.C. Metropolitan policeman, and Sweet William, who's anything but sweet, and he was an attorney on Capitol Hill. And those four men, you know, very imperfect human beings. I know the intimate details of their lives, and they were not saints, but they carried a perfect message to this guy here. And when I got to that fourth step, that word perfect came to haunt me because I wanted to do this thing perfectly, you know. In the days when I came in, they told you very clearly, you don't do a fourth and fifth step, you're going to drink again. And after 30 days, I came to the understanding that I hadn't had a drink in 30 days. I mean, that was a thing that came into my brain. I didn't know it. I didn't realize that I'd gone 30 days without a drink. And right at that point, I met what I call the perils of the partially cured. You know, I was feeling physically well again. And I wanted to get onto this fourth step because they were hounding you. You know, if you don't do a fourth and fifth step, you're going to drink. So, okay, I did it. What I did, I got the big book, and I went and I read the big book. And then I got the 12 and 12, and I read the 12 and 12. And then I got the Hazleton Guide number one. And then I got the Hazleton Guide number two. And then I got the little red book, which you used to use in those days, which is really a great book. I love it. And then I got Jack Smith's 54 questions. And then I got Tom Jones' 534 questions. And I got totally confused. And Jim Landy, God bless him, when he said, you know, Larry, when you get done all that reading, because I told him how confused I was, he said, anybody would be confused with that much reading. He said, just come on back and I'll tell you how to do a four step. Two other things very important to me and my experience of the four step happened for me in my recovery. One was as I was attempting to, you know, mentally get to that point that, okay, I can take pen in hand. And they did tell me to use a pen because I'd probably erase something written in pencil. And so I had my pen and I had my paper and I wasn't doing anything. But I was going, I mean, I was going to a lot of meetings. I still do, thank God. And I went to a four-step meeting. And at four-step meeting, this guy stood up and shared. It was a 12 and 12 meeting, four-step. The guy got up at the podium and he shared. I'd never met him before in my life. And he shared, you know, his experience with the fourth step. And he got to the point, he said, if you're sitting out there tonight, anything you've done, I've either done or thought about doing. Anything you've done, I've either done or thought about doing. And I'm sitting in the back, and I'm saying, mm-mm. No, he doesn't know. He didn't do what I did. Nobody else has done what I've done. And I sat there and I listened attentively and the meeting went on and it closed and I went up to him after the meeting. I had never met him before. And I walked up and shook hands and said, hi, I'm Larry, I'm an alcoholic. And he said, hi, so-and-so. And I said, did you mean what you said earlier tonight? Now, without any prompting on my part whatsoever, he looked me in the eye and he said, yeah. Anything you've done, I've either done or thought about doing. He knew exactly what I was referring to. And that was enough of a freedom, of a release, from my own fear about what everything about me and all self-centeredness for me to be able to start writing on that paper. The other thing that happened was we had a meeting in College Park, Maryland. It was a good old meeting. Been there a long time, and they do three steps and periodically do it. I went there one night. It was a fourth, fifth, and sixth step. And there was a young man sharing. I'd say he was young. He was in his 30s, early 30s at the time, but he had like 19 years sobriety. And so impressed the heck out of me. And he was doing the fourth step, and he said, you share what you got when you got it. He said, write it down and share it, and you share what you got when you got it. Well, I went on, and I did my writing, and I put it all down on paper and got it in the best format that I could. And I have to share this, and I know we're on the fourth step, but I'm going to share this one little piece about the fifth step because it was important for me. I got it all done, and I knew who I was going to share it with. And even though our book suggests if we want to, we can use a clergyman if we're of that persuasion. And I did that for part of it afterwards. But I also wanted to share eyeball with eyeball to the persons that were going to see me in this room, in these rooms, so that somebody would know who I am and know everything about me. And I agreed to share with another man, and some of the people out here have heard this story before, but I'll tell you. And I went up to him. I was on a retreat, and on Friday night I went up and shared my four-step with him in depth. Everything, I bared my soul. I told every detail that was there. And at the end of it, some tears came out, and we hugged, and you know, said. And I went back and I did what the big book says about the fifth step, you know, and I reflected upon what I had just done, and I went to bed at peace that night, probably the most peaceful sleep I'd had in years. And the next morning on the retreat, we had prayers before the breakfast in the morning in the chapel, 5 minutes worth of prayers. And I went in the chapel and I sat there and I'm waiting, and you know, it's about to start, and I look around and he's not there. And I thought, oh my God, what I shared with him last night was so bad that he has left this retreat and he's probably drank again. And everybody here is going to know that I shared my fifth step with him last night. And I went through 5 minutes of eternity, sweating bullets, praying, crying, everything. Oh my God, what have I done? I got to face all these people. As soon as we get out of this prayer, we're going to walk to breakfast. They're all going to know. They're going to know about me. And I go to walk down the hallway. The prayers are over. I don't even know what was said for prayers. The prayers are over. I'm walking down the hallway, and all of a sudden, this arm comes over my shoulder from behind, and this voice says, "Do you feel as good about last night as I do?" The reason I hadn't seen him, he was sitting directly behind me in the chapel. I'm going to close here now, and I need to thank a lot of people. I need to thank God, obviously. I need to thank Jack for letting me borrow his jacket, because if my sponsor knew that I was standing up here and I don't have a tie and jacket on, I'd have an awful lot of questions to answer to that man. But I'm grateful to God, to Alcoholics Anonymous, to you people. There's a friend of mine that once before gave me an opportunity just to bop in and say something at a world conference, a guy named Hal Marley, who's passed on. And Hal says every day, you know, I thank God I'm alive, I thank God I'm sober, and I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I also thank God for each and every one of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Larry. That was just great. And our next speaker is Jack from Washington, D.C.
Hello, my name is Jack, and I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is the Camel Group of Washington, D.C., which is the best home group in North America. And if your home group's not the best home group in North America, it's your responsibility to make it that. So I love everyone in the Camel Group. Hi, Camels. My sobriety date is March 31st, 1990. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. My sponsor's here today. And I sponsor Men in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say that because that puts me right in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, years ago when I first came to AA, I had no idea what the journey in AA would be about. I'm a little nervous too, Larry, and I don't know why, because I speak for a living, I write speeches for a living, and I tell other people how to speak for a living, and you know, here I am talking to all you all. I feel like my clothes are off, and you know exactly who I am. So let me ask God for help, and that's where I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, to ask God for help, no matter what it is. Today, and I'm just so lucky. I want to thank World Services for inviting me to speak, and it's an honor and privilege. And since this is about fearless and searching, this session is about fearless and searching, I don't think it's just about the four step, Larry. I've had a longer time to think about this than you. And I should have sent you my notes, but and I've never taken notes to speak, but I actually think that. When we talk about fear in Alcoholics Anonymous, All of us knows what that means. There used to be a guy, I got sober in Southern California, in Los Angeles, and on the west side of Los Angeles, and there used to be a guy who would always say that fear was false evidence appearing real. And I thought I was a very smart guy when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd gone to the best schools in America and was well educated, I thought, and had one degree heading toward another. And I said, I couldn't understand what that meant, false evidence appearing real. I mean, he would say it over and over and over again. And I know a little bit more today what that means, is that when I'm in a fearful place, when I experience fear, which is normally right in my gut, that is the moment when, for me, the great adventure begins. That's the kind of telltale sign that tells me it's time to get into action and just walk through the fear no matter what it is. And I think every single person, if you all have at least one day of sobriety, we know what fear is, and we also know what it takes to live through fear, which is courage. Because every day we make a decision not to take a drink, no matter what's going on in our life, whether it's a relationship or money or job or someone's not paying enough attention to me, I have courage to live through that day without finding it necessary to take a drink or a drug. And I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea that that was one of the gifts that comes with our program, which is courage. Though the word courage, the French root for it is from the heart. And when I think about that, liqueur is the word, and when I think about, not liquor, liqueur, I just saw some people nodding their heads going, he's one of those alcoholics. I never drank liqueur. I drank hard scotch, and I loved scotch. But liqueur, the French word, means from the heart. And when I think about that, fear so often comes from the head. It makes me go back to that phrase, false evidence appearing real, where, it's what's in my head that makes me think that something's going to happen to me. It's what's in my head that makes me dream that the worst thing that's possibly going to happen, and that in fact is going to kill me. When I think from my heart, and AA brought me to my heart. AA taught me how to live out loud from my heart. AA is about the heart. Every single person here. I mean, just last night at the big meeting, it was, I'm not a person who gets goosebumps, but I got goosebumps when I saw, the person from the First Nation begin the whole ceremony. I'm absolutely amazed at the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and the miracles of us sitting here today. Now, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't that much of a miracle, even though I thought it, I was one of those people. I was a legend in my mind. I had a severe sense of entitlement, even though I was living in my car, who I choose to call Ruby. I had a Brooks Brothers suit with a hole inside it, and I had a pair of Gucci shoes that someone had lent me or given me, or I'd stolen. I don't remember, but anyway, that's how I had to look, even though I had not a dime to my name. No one who wanted to employ me. I was estranged from my family, and my best friend was alcohol. My last and only friend was alcohol, King Alcohol. And I didn't start off that way. I grew up in Ohio in a middle-class family where I was thinking this morning, I was having a great laugh with someone this morning, that if my mother would have heard our first speaker last night talk about having a baby in prison, and my mother was sitting in his rooms today, she would say, "Why are you hanging out with those kind of people?" And my mother calls AA double A. That's what she calls it triple A. She calls it triple A. Both my parents had a very particular way for me to be. They wanted me to be the perfect boy, and I was the perfect boy. I was, at least to them, when I wanted them to know that, to be the perfect boy. But I knew to my core, as a result, by the way, of the four steps that I do once a year with a group of men, that I am to my core a troublemaker. I have been my whole life. I remember in kindergarten getting everyone in trouble in my kindergarten class because I had organized a protest against a teacher because I didn't like what she was doing. And everyone got in trouble but me, you know. And that was my whole life. I knew exactly when to disappear when things got tight. And so I had a very good way of approximating what it is that you wanted me to be or do, and so that I could be what I wanted to be when you weren't around, when I wasn't responsible to you. And I think that's a lot of what the alcohol did for me. I was able to go to the best schools, and I was able to have this great job. And, you know, I really identify with Bill Wilson's life of being I was a young investment banker on Wall Street, and, you know, I love Bill Wilson's life, where it seems like it's like a roller coaster. It kind of ratchets up and ratchets up and ratchets up, and then he crashes, and then he gets everyone to come along with him, and then he crashes, and then he gets everyone to come along with him, and then he crashes, and that was my life. He says I was to my core a troublemaker and a huge dreamer, and I think a lot of us in these rooms are dreamers. I think it's, someone used to say in my old home group, you know, AAs are probably some of the smartest people around because we're clever and we know how to hustle you when we need it, and we know how to just aim and get there when we focus. Because look at our drinking. Look at my drinking. When I made up my mind at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock to have a cocktail, you know, nothing, absolutely nothing would get in my way to the effect I felt with that cocktail and the result of that afterwards. So continue to drink, and the drink takes the man, and then I'm gone. But my growing up in Ohio, and my growing up with my father, who is a powerful man in many ways. My dad is the kind of person. He's 92 today, and he has Alzheimer's. But you know, he's the kind of person who you absolutely knew what the rules were in his life. And you followed them, absolutely. I remember as a kid being invited to a wedding, and it's funny for me to put a jacket on because my father said, I was only about 9 or 10 years old. It was a family wedding. It was hot, steamy day in July, and all my cousins were taking off their jackets and handing them to their parents, and so I ran to my father and said, Dad, can you take my jacket? And my father says, my son does not take his jacket off. And I proceeded to cry. He says, stop crying. Don't take your jacket off. And that is my father had rules. My father had a way of perceiving what he thought a boy was supposed to be. It was basically a miniature man. And so as I grew up, and I remember when I sobered up, and of course my family knew absolutely nothing about me living in my car and my Brooks Brothers suit and the borrowed shoes, which would have horrified my father and he would have disowned me. But it was about 90 days sober and I was terrified, and I called my sponsor I had then. I said, my parents are coming to Los Angeles and I'm just terrified. I'm a mess. They don't want to, I didn't even have a house really. I was living with someone, I think, on someone's couch. So I was managing this visit by my parents, and my father gets off the plane. My dad's always he's a dandy. He's a Southern guy and always had seersucker suits and straw hats and, you know, patent leather shoes. I mean, he always looked fabulous. And he goes, as he gets off the plane, he says, why are you dressed like a bum today? And I said, well, it was 100 degrees in Los Angeles that day, and it was, you know, I had a pair of shorts on, probably the only pair of shorts I had at that time. And, you know, I tried my best to look good for my father. It was always about looking good for them. No matter what was going on inside of me, it was always about looking good and being perfect for them. And my father said at dinner that night, you know, of all my children, you disappoint me the most. And I had enough AA in me at that time because someone told me that day earlier in a meeting, and I thank God for AA. I thank God for you people who tell me the truth, because that's really what the fourth step is about, and so much of our program is about the truth, that I said to my father, first time ever in my life, I said, Dad, I am sorry you feel that way. And the dance of death stopped with him. Because my own behavior would be, as we were sitting at dinner having a cocktail, would be, well, let me tell you about your other children and why you should like me more than you like them. And so I didn't have to have that conversation with him, and I learned something that my sponsor told me then. If you just simply acknowledge him and move on, he will stop fighting with you. And that's what I learned from that experience. I went on to do a four-step with my sponsor where he said to me after listening to me for 5 hours, which was a miraculous experience for me to do that in my fifth step, he said, you and your father compete a lot with each other. And I said, what do you mean, compete with each other? I mean, my father, provided for us and ran the household and did everything else. And he says, well, you told me your father has a sixth grade education, but he in turn sent you to the best schools in America, gave you the best camps, the best vacations. And he's wondering, why aren't you doing better in life? And, and he's wondering, why can't he have, he's confused about why everything that he's giving you, that you're not more grateful, or that you're not figuring life out. And so there's the fight. There's the competition with each other. And I think that so much of our program, and when we read about the fourth step, is about swallowing some big truths about yourself. So I find that this journey on about the truth is so important for us and for me. In a session yesterday, which was on the spiritual journey through the Big Book, it was, if any of you went to that, it was just amazing. And it was just talking about how Bill and others developed the Big Book. And one of the early forms of the 12 steps that Bill kind of scribbled on a piece of paper. The second step was get honest with self. And the third step, or the third element of what Bill saw was the program Alcoholics Anonymous, was then get honest with another. And the honesty was a hard thing for me. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had created a whole different personality for myself. I mean, before I came in, I mentioned I had gone to a well-known school, and I was just this middle-class black kid from Ohio, going to a school with people who flew in on private jets. Their parents came to parents' weekend on private jets, and some of their parents did, or I thought all of their parents did, but really, just a couple. But that was enough for me to say that my dad, too, had a private jet, and we, too, at Christmas went down to Little Abaco in the Bahamas, which was not true, and that, we, too, had a house in Martha's Vineyard, and that, we, too, my grandfather was the first black federal judge. I just kept inventing something other than me, other than the truth of me, which was just fine, but I didn't know who me was till I arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous. Until I started to do these steps. And then when I started to find out more about me as a result of doing these steps, I started to fall in love with me. I don't know about you, but the other day I was driving in my car and I was laughing out loud. The radio wasn't playing or anything else. I was just laughing out loud. And I remember catching myself and saying, isn't this what it's all about? That I can laugh. I wasn't laughing at anyone. I was just laughing because I was just happy. And I was just feeling a sense of joy. And it wasn't about anything specific. It's just where I was in that space of my life that particular day. And when I get the glimpse of that every now and then, it doesn't happen for me every day, I get so grateful about Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I mentioned that the word courage is so important when I think about fear, because of the way that I get to walk through the fear in my life, and the way that if I don't continue to be, as we're talking about, fearless and searching in my life, that I think it gets harder and harder to be here. My sponsor is just saying to me, I'm really grateful my sponsor's here, and I love him very much, and he teaches me so much every day, and as does so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said to me something this morning. He said, when you first get to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's just you have to do this much to get this much. But the longer you stay here, you have to do this much just to get that much, you know. And by that, if you're not listening to this on a tape, is that you have to work harder just to get a little bit of change in your life. And this program is all about change. It doesn't stop. You know, it just doesn't stop. There's just one thing after another that comes to you. And I mentioned to my father, I never knew that the man that I wrestled with and fought with and tried so hard to run away from and to ignore his teachings in life, that, you know, that my life would change so dramatically, like almost overnight, that I get to care for my father. And I'm sitting there and I'm giving my father a bath. And he's resisting it because he says, I can take care of myself, son. I said, Dad, but you can't lift your arm. Let me just help you get in the bathtub. And he says, okay. And I start to do that. And he says, I'm fine, son. Just leave the bathroom now. And so I leave the room and I hear this, help, help, help. And I go inside, my father slipping into the bathtub, and I pull him up and I start to give him a bath. And at that moment, and I'm in tears, I'm crying, I say, the man who I could never say the word, I hated my father, but I didn't want anything to do with him either. And I avoided him because he scared me so, because he was so demanding, and because I could never live up to his demands in life. And that somehow, miraculously, the Alcoholics Anonymous had given me the privilege to be present and to show up and give him love. In the ninth tradition, I think it says that there are two great teachers for us, which is great pain and great love. The great pain, of course, is that is the incomprehensible demoralization I felt as I was sleeping in Ruby's car. I had 35 cents to my name, and my last friend in my life, other than alcohol, wasn't home that day to give me lunch at his house because I expected to have lunch at his house. And as I went and I was going to these spiritual lectures in Los Angeles, and because at the time in my bottom, my last few months before I walked in these rooms, you know, I was looking for something to fill me up inside, because I knew that the problem for me is that I had great expectations of who I was supposed to be, which was up here, but my behavior was always down here. And it's just my belief, my experience, is that who I wanted to be, who I wanted to think I was, and who I truly was the pain that I used to justify the drinking. The alcohol took away that pain of self, the way that the person you can't look at in the mirror every day. And so, the day that I got sober, I had gone to the spiritual lecture, and the meditation that day was, and God should wipe away all tears. And for the first time in years, I cried, and I couldn't stop crying. I was weeping, really. And that's when I realized that I could no longer take a drink, and that I heard a voice, which I now know to be my higher power, saying, I need you as a sober man. And I haven't found it necessary to have a drink or have a drug ever since then. And I was a garden variety, fall-down drunk that drank every single day, no matter how I felt. And now I'm a recovering man who gets the opportunity to give his dad a bath, and who gets to a few months ago was my dad's 92nd birthday, and I flew in for a day. I stopped my work life, and I flew in to celebrate the day, my dad's birthday, with two of his girlfriends, which were each over 100 years old. And as I'm sitting having lunch with about people who were average age was 95, about 10 of them, and as they were nibbling bits of cake, and this one of Dad's girlfriends said, "Now who are you again?" And I said, "That's my father." "Oh, I like your father. Who are you again?" You know. Mind you, my mother and father are still married, but in different places, and it's a long story. But, I walked in, and I saw my father, and I rubbed my hands through his hair, which is very soft now, and I look into his little eyes, and I feel his little bony hand, his little bony shoulders, and I said, "Dad, I love you so much." And he says, "Well, thank you, son. I love you too." And despite where he is mentally, that to know that, you know, we talked about the experience of the heart, is that thank God for AA. Here I am. Here I am, not by my own design, not by, if you would, most of my life, I don't know about you, but if someone had told me that you're going to have the life that you have today, I said, you've got to be out of your mind. Because I did truly imagine that my life would be, you know, Learjets, a house on Park Avenue, a house in Long Island, and, you know, 15 children. That was my idea of what I want. And that was, and all that was because other people had those things, and I thought that's who I was supposed to be. And so when we talk about the fearless and searching, when we talk about the inventory, when we talk about seeking the truth and find out who we are through our inventory process, whether it be the fourth step or the tenth step, that we start to find out who we are, we start to love who we are, at least for me, that's what's happened. And we start to, I think, I've started to accept that whatever God gives me, wherever He wants to be, that I have to be willing to be there. I have to be willing to meet you there. And so I'm incredibly, incredibly grateful for that. In the fourth step, I just want to say one other thing before I sit down, and I realize my time might be up, is, where is it? There's a four-step prayer that's on page 67 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it says, we ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. These are the people that we have resentments with and that we're struggling with in life. And when a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. When I look so much at the anger and the resentments and the challenges that I've had with other people in my life, whether it be family, my kindergarten teacher, you people in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I've learned here that as I continue to do this inventory, as I continue to do these inventories, I continue to take a look at myself, as I continue to listen closely and be aware of how I'm changing and what direction God wants me to be in, that I get to experience life happy, joyous, and free. And so with that, I thank you all. I'm very grateful to be here.
And thank you, Larry. And in my invitation, in my loving invitation, they asked me to share just briefly my experience, strength, and hope. So I'm just going to do that briefly, folks. As I said before, my name's Lori. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lori.
Right now I live in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And it's a beautiful place. My son and I love it there. This is the longest place, longest time that we've lived somewhere. I'm 6 years sober, and we've lived there 6 years. Um, 2005 has been a huge year for us. We went to the General Service Conference in April. My son turned 10 in May, and here we are in Toronto. This has been a huge year for us, and none of this would be possible if I was still out there drinking. I'm the daughter of an Irish drunk. I'm half Irish, and I watched him die. I watched him drink himself to death. It's a hard thing for a 9-year-old to watch your dad put his fist through a plate glass window. It's hard to watch a lot of things. I vowed that I would never use alcohol ever because it destroyed my folks' marriage. It destroyed everything in our lives. We couldn't depend on Dad. He was in jail or he was in bar fights or, you know, he could not keep a job. And so we couldn't depend on him. We moved in with Grandma after the divorce, and they told me that Dad was evil. He was an evil man. And so I grew up thinking that that was true. And it hurt me a lot because I loved him. Because when he was dry, he was a great guy. You know, take us fishing and ice cream, and it was wonderful. And when he was drinking, he was a monster. So, I, you know, I grew up having these different feelings, and I always felt like an outsider. And when I discovered alcohol at age 19, I knew I'd died and gone to heaven. I thought to myself, well, now I know why he has been drinking all these years, because this is my painkiller. I don't have to feel all the emotions that I've been feeling, all the anger and the hurt, and you know, all the suffering that, we had felt. And that began my career, my drinking career. And for the next 22 years, I drank alcoholically. I've also given myself the nickname the Recovering Serial Marrier. you know, that was me, always the bride, never the bridesmaid. Yeah. And always the same type of person, too. But, you know, my drinking career isn't that much different than anyone else's, really. It got worse and worse, and I did crazier and crazier things. And then God gave me a huge gift, and I became a mother. And when Jacob was born, I knew that I had to change. But I continued to drink. I tried to stop. I could stop for 90 days, and that was it. And then I would drink again. And when he was 3.5 years old, his dad and I got divorced. Divorce number 3. And I decided that maybe it wasn't them. Maybe it wasn't the guys. Maybe it was me. That maybe I'm the one who has the problem, and I'm the one who needs to get fixed. I was too busy trying to fix everybody else, and I needed to fix myself. And so I came to AA. And in February of 1999, God willing, I stopped for the last time. I took my last drink February 20th, 1999. And that's a huge thing when you're descended from a long line of Irish drunks, because most of the Irish drunks are dead in my family, and I was on that road too. I didn't think I was worth saving when I came into this program. I thought I was lower than dirt. I'd been told I was dirt forever by all three husbands, that I was just nothing more than a low down dirty drunk, basically, and then if I divorced him, nobody would ever want me, and so I might as well stay. And I didn't stay. We got divorced. I moved out, and I came to AA. And my life has never been the same, and it's never been better. I think I'm breaking the cycle of the alcoholism that has ruled my family. And my son, he was certainly worth saving. I did this for him in the beginning. He deserved to have a sober parent when I grew up with such a violent and unpredictable one. Months sober, and that started to change everything, because when I sat down with my sponsor and I did my fourth step and I shared it with her, it changed. I started to like myself a little bit. I didn't hate myself anymore. And with each successive fourth and fifth step, I've been able to let go of more and more of the anger and the resentment and the frustration and everything that used to just eat me alive, the reasons that I drank, the things I was running from all my life. And how I met my sponsor is I went to this 8 a.m. women's meeting, and it was recommended, but I was 1 week sober. It was recommended by some folks, and so I showed up, and she showed up, and we talked for a minute. And I told her, I said, my dad is dying from alcoholism. He's in a home right now, and he drank all his life, and he's near death. And she said, well, you're going to end up just like him if you don't change. And it was like, wow, she is so blunt. But she was right, and it made me think. And no one had really been that blunt with me before about it. And I'd always compared my drinking with my dad's drinking, and I always came out smelling like a rose, so to speak. I wasn't as bad as my dad. Consequently, I could continue drinking. But I do want to talk more about the fourth step, because it's been the one that has really helped to make me happy, joyous, and free. It's the one that helps me look at myself in the mirror in the morning. It's the one that helps lighten my load. I can, it's like I can look at myself in the mirror. I can stand up straighter. I don't have to carry all that stuff around that I carried my entire life. And my sponsor told me, she said, it's kind of like unpacking a suitcase. You know, just unpack what's on top first. And so I started doing that. She said, if it's getting in your way, then we probably ought to write about it. If you can't function, if you're really bothered about it, then you probably should sit down and write about it. And I have. And when I've come up against an obstacle in my life, I have sat down, and I do write about it. I went through a 4-year custody battle for my son. I was sober the whole time. And he lives with me during the school year now. And his dad is an attorney and a former state trooper. And it was a fight. It was a fight. And he's a good man. It's not that he's not a good man. It's just that it didn't work out. And everything that has happened to me in sobriety, I have grown. I'm a different person today than I was 6 years ago. My son, if you do a fourth step, everyone benefits. You benefit, your family benefits, your coworkers benefit. Everyone benefits. I didn't know what my character defects were until I did a searching and fearless moral inventory. My big three are anger, fear, and self-pity. Those are my big three, and I constantly work on them. You know, along with, resentments and procrastination and, others. I also just want to say that I'm a true believer in counseling. I think that some of us need some outside counseling, too. I took advantage of it. However, I sometimes think that maybe the client should be doing the writing. The writing has helped me so much, because I start out in a place of anger and resentment, and somebody did something to me and I'm really upset. And then after I write it all down, I end up in this place of peace and acceptance and forgiveness. And how does that happen? And that's what happens when I write everything down. I get it all out, and I'm able to share that with someone else. I just want to say that I have a second chance at life because of this program, and many of you are probably familiar with the group The Eagles. I'm sure many of you are familiar. Don Henley and Glenn Frey and all those guys. I've loved The Eagles since I was 14 years old. Still love them today. There's this line in Hotel California that says that we are all just prisoners here of our own device. And that described me perfectly when I was drinking. I was a prisoner. And, today I'm no longer a prisoner. I'm happy, joyous, and free. And I owe it all to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thanks, everybody, for being here. Okay, folks, I guess we're going to close. I'm going to close a little early. you know, thank you everyone for coming, and thank you to my speakers. They were just wonderful. For those of you who would like to join us, we'll close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Keep coming back. Work sift, work it.